tell, I got a little bit wet this morning. So, but I'll trade a wet shirt for a baptism any day of the week. I used to keep a spare shirt, but it's disappeared somewhere. So everything kind of grows legs and walks away. You know, vacations are fun. And a lot of times, half the fun of a vacation is getting there. And, you know, Renee and I are from West Texas, and, you know, we have become road warriors, so to speak, on that jaunt out to West Texas. And, you know, it's really a pretty simple trip. You get on Interstate 59 right outside of Chattanooga here. You go down to Birmingham, and you get on Interstate 20 going west. And you stay on Interstate 20 going west for about 850 miles. And you end up just a couple miles. There's an exit about a couple miles from where Renee and I are from. You get off right there, and you're almost home. So it's a pretty easy trip. There's not a lot of turns, not a lot of interstates or roads that you need to get on. Easy peasy, right? Well, most of the time. Now, there was this one instance, I don't know, maybe 10 years ago. We were going through Alabama on our way to West Texas, and I was just getting really sleepy, and so just about the Alabama-Mississippi state line, I turned things over to Renee. Just a second here. I turned things over to Renee, and I went to sleep, and I slept for about an hour, and then I remember waking up, and, you know, I'm still kind of groggy, and I hadn't really moved, and she doesn't know I was really awake, and I'm just kind of watching things go by the window in a blur as my head's leaning on the pillow there on the window. And then I saw a sign that said, Hattiesburg, Mississippi, 10 miles. Now, Hattiesburg is a fine town, don't get me wrong. But Hattiesburg is not on Interstate 20, and Hattiesburg is not on your way to West Texas. So I am instantly wide awake and bombarding Renee with questions. What are we doing in Hattiesburg? How did we get here? What are we doing on Interstate 59 again? You know, I'm very calm. I mean, I understand how you can make a mistake like that, right? Just, you know, no big deal, right? Of course. And so we were 2 hours out of our way. And when you're on a 17-hour trip, that's just what you want, right? To add a few more extra hours to your trip. What would you do if you were on a long trip and the guy that's leading the way kept saying that you would be there shortly, but it took 39 years? What would you think about that? In our journey through the Bible, we've kind of come to the point now in our series, The Story, where Moses is getting ready to lead the Israelites to the promised land. He's taking them to the land of Canaan. And so he's going from Egypt and he's going to the land of Canaan. And if you could, throw up that first map up there, if you could, the first map. Can you put that first map up on the screen for me, please? Now, I don't know, I hope you can see this well. If you look at that map, Goshen is Egypt. And if you look at that first black line at the top of that map, you can see from Egypt or Goshen to the land of Canaan is a pretty direct route if you're going right under the sea there. And it's actually called the Way of the Sea. That's what that road is actually called. You'll also notice another black line not too far under that that's the caravan route. So when you look at that, it looks like it's a pretty direct route, and it was a very popular route, it was a very scenic route, and it's about 175 miles. You know, that's not too bad of a journey, 175 miles, it's kind of scenic, it's a well-traveled route, and so I was trying to kind of put this in context for us today. So 175 miles, I was kind of doing some math in my head. What would be close to 175 miles from Ringgold? And I started looking around, and Macon is about 193 miles. So it's very close. And so I got out my map on my phone, my GPS, and did you know that there's a hiking icon on your phone? I didn't know that. So like I punch it in for like hiking, and it says that it would take 2 days and 18 hours from Ringgold to Macon. That seems a little aggressive to me, don't you think? I guess that means you don't stop and you don't eat or any of those kind of things. But I started looking at it and then kind of figuring, well, you know, if you, 20 miles a day, that's fairly, you know, easy to walk. I don't know if it's easy, but you can do 20 miles a day. So I get to thinking, I said, 20 miles a day, so you're looking at 11, 12 days, something like that. That's not too bad. And but then you got to think, well, there's a lot of people, so it might be a little bit longer than that. But so I started doing some math, and I thought, okay, just to be on the safe side, let's say a month. So let's imagine tomorrow morning, you and I and 2 to 3 million of our best friends, we leave Ringgold to walk to Macon. And 11 days if we hustle, but we know it's probably not going to go that way because of all the people. And we got to go through Atlanta, so that's going to take some time, even on foot. So we'll just say a month. A month max. Pretty easy, right? But here's what I want you to know this morning. Just like the Israelites' journey, our journey often takes longer than we expect. I want you to notice how this journey starts this morning for the Israelites. Numbers chapter 10, verse 11. All these scriptures will be on the screen, and we're going to be jumping around a little bit this morning as we look at their journey. But it says, on the 20th day of the second month of the second year, the cloud lifted from above the tabernacle of the covenant law. Then the Israelites set out from the desert of Sinai and traveled from place to place until the cloud came to rest in the desert of Paran. They set out this first time at the Lord's command through Moses. And if we were to read some other scriptures there, this was a big day. And the trumpets were sounding and the cymbals were clashing. And I mean, these folks are stoked. They are, you know, like we would be going on vacation. They are finally going to the land of Canaan. This is going to be great. 11 days, we're going to be there. But that's not what happened. It didn't take 11 days. God took them on a much different route. In case you don't know this, I kind of want to give you a little tip this morning. In life, God usually doesn't take us on the direct route. He doesn't usually take us on the scenic route. He usually doesn't take us on the most traveled route. God usually has a journey for us that is much different than what we think is going to be. And in this case, the Israelites take a very indirect route as they go from Egypt to the promised land. I want you to put up that next map there if you would. So that next map, if you look at the red, you can see how they journey. They immediately left Egypt and went south. And then they begin to go north and they begin to run around in these circles and that kind of thing. And eventually it takes 39 years. I mean, they head out. And they spend their first time there. You can see right off the bat, they go south and they end up at Mount Sinai. They spend about a year there, and 39 years starts after that. It's actually 40 all told. But they spend about a year there. They get the Ten Commandments and those kind of things. And, you know, that's a pretty good pit stop. But you can tell from there that Mount Sinai back to the land of Canaan is still looking like about 11 days, right? About 11 days. A month, we're saying. Deuteronomy chapter 1, verse 2 says this. It takes 11 days to go from Horeb to Kadesh Barnea by the Mount Seir Road. Turn left on Mount Seir Road. 11 days, you hit the promised land, right? 11 days, that's how long it was supposed to take, right? 39 years of traveling dusty roads. And you know what else? 39 years of quail and manna. I mean, that's bologna sandwiches for breakfast, bologna sandwiches for lunch, bologna sandwiches for supper. Not to mention, we got to lug that big tent around and set it up and take it down all the time. And you know, if you're like me, travel's kind of a competition, isn't it? I mean, if you're a competitive person, travel is like a competition. You're competing against the clock, right? You remember the old Garmins that you used to put on your dash before we all had the cell phone GPSs? If they didn't want you to compete, why did they put that little blue race car on there? You know what I'm saying? I mean, you put that little blue race car on there, you punch in your numbers, and it pops up and it says it's going to take you this long to go from point A to point B. Instantly, I'm like, ooh, I can beat that. You know what I'm talking about? I mean, that's the way we are. So Moses, he pulls out, you know, maybe, okay, 11 days on my GPS. 39 years later. And this time in Israel's history, this 39, 40 years, is known as the wandering period, wandering in the wilderness. And God is not taking them on the direct path. Which brings me to my second point this morning. Our journey is often living in the space between where you are and where you want to be. You could literally define wandering this way: living in the space between where I started and where I want to be. Living in the space between where I started and where I want to be. And you know what? God does a lot of work in our lives while we travel in that space. My guess is that for many of you, that kind of describes your life. Living in the space between where you are and where you want to be. It's living in the space between finishing school and graduating. It's living in the space between graduating and getting a real job. It's living in the space between dating and getting married. It's living in the space between becoming a family and deciding when to have that first child. It's living in the space between diagnosis and remission. It's living in the space between getting into debt and getting out of debt. It's living in the space between letting go at your job and finding a new job. It's living in that space between saying goodbye to a loved one and being reunited with them one day in heaven. And the question is, how do you live in that space between? How do you respond to God when you're like the Israelites and you're wandering around? I'll be honest with you, I don't think a lot of us do well in that space. Because we're much more about the journey, or we're much more about the destination than we are about the journey. We want to get there. We're not so crazy about the journey. The journey seems innate. We just want to be there. Parents, what is it your kids always ask you when you go on a road trip? Are we there yet? When are we going to be there? Or some derivative thereof. That's what they all ask. Anybody's kids ever ask them, like, before you get out of the neighborhood, raise your hand here. Before you even get out of the neighborhood, are we there yet? Yeah, a couple of hands there. The answer is no. We have 39 more episodes of SpongeBob before we're going to get there. Or Paw Patrol, whatever it happens to be. But we're just like our kids. We don't like the journey. We want the destination. And our tendency is to focus and just eliminate as much time as we possibly can so that we can get there. We don't like wandering. We're in a hurry. Our culture is marked by hurry. How fast can I get it over with so that I can get to the destination? And in case you're not with me on this and maybe think that I'm not telling the truth, I want you to take a little quiz this morning, okay? You're in church, so don't lie. And hopefully this quiz will make you feel guilty about your fact that you're in a hurry all the time. Question number one. I have cut through a gas station to avoid stopping at red lights. Well, a few people are even honest about it. And I've seen some of you others. I've seen you doing it. I frequently look at my clock or watch. Raise your hand. Yeah, I know who you are. I see you up here looking at your phones. And I know you're not cross-referencing the scripture and looking deeper. I know what you're doing. You ever going to get done? Some of you know there's a clock on the TV back there, and I see you and you don't think I'm looking. Where's it going to finish? People who talk slowly irritate me. Every word is not supposed to be a sentence, right? become annoyed when the person at the checkout line uses a check. It's the 21st century. Yeah. We're not in the Flintstones anymore. Get out your check card. You don't have to write in your car either. Coupons are. Man, Philip, you're in a bad place now. People are going to be after you. You can answer for your spouse on this one. When I am delayed and am running late, I am irrationally upset. You vote for your spouse? Yeah, okay. That's what I thought. I have difficulty finding time for things like doctor's appointments.
Yeah.
And lastly, I feel compelled to leave the church early so I can beat the restaurant rush. You don't have to raise your hand. We'll wave bye to you during the invitation. I know when you leave. It feels like I pray, and then I look up, and I was like, there was a whole pew full of people there. Where'd you go? I'm serious. It happens all the time. You know who you are. But you know, I get it. I really do. I mean, we're in a hurry, and we're just always trying to eliminate as much time as we can from the journey so that we can get there. So that we don't have to go through the space in between. You know, this happens to me when I go on vacation. Right? I told you, we're in a hurry. Got to get there. And Renee's like, well, why are we in such a hurry to get there? Why don't we just go? Just got to get there. But why? Well, we just are. Why can't we stop and see this? Because we don't have time. Why? What are we going to do when we get there? Well, we're going to rest when we get there. Well, why are we in a hurry to rest? Because I'm just in a hurry to get there and do nothing. And besides, I'm trying to make that little blue card on the GPS. And that's the way we are. We just want to get through it. Now, I've been lighthearted, but there's a serious part to this. As you go through your own story and you experience God in your life, God is not in a hurry, is he? I mean, we have seen that. You'll see it in your own story if you haven't already. We've seen it in what we've studied so far. God said, Abraham, I'm going to make a great nation of you. It was decades before he had kids. We look at Joseph, and he gets enslaved, and it's 13 years before God's plan kind of gets revealed to him. We look at Moses, and they're wandering around for 40 years. Later, we're going to look at King David. God said, you're going to be the king. It was 20 years. Before he became the king. God is not in a hurry. What we think should maybe take 11 days might take 39 years. And God is working in our lives during that time. Third thing, in our journey, God is more concerned with who you are becoming than where you are going. That's what God is concerned about. Who you are becoming. In this story of the Israelites, he's going to do some work in their life and help them to figure some things out during those 40 years. Because he's more concerned about who they are becoming than where they are going. And it's true in our lives too. He's more concerned with who we are becoming. And we don't want to wait. But oftentimes, that's what God wants. He does some of his best work when we're in the wilderness. Wondering is where God makes us who he wants us to be. I had supper a Friday night with about five couples that we all went to seminary together. First time some of us had been together in years. And, you know, as you do in those kind of things, we started telling stories. And people were relating stories of what seminary was like for them and how difficult it was. And I didn't have kids when I started seminary. I didn't have Bonnie until like a month or two before I graduated. 6 months before we graduated. But anyway, these guys had 2 and 3 kids and finding jobs and leaving everything that they had known, and they're, you know, in their mid-30s. And we were just talking about how hard and difficult it was to balance everything and how there were times when you didn't know where you were going to pay for stuff. You know, there was $1,000 in bills due and the bank account says zero. And we were talking about all that stuff, and then one of the ladies made an observation at the end of kind of our conversation. She said, I don't think any of us wanted to go through that, but God used all of that to make us who we are today. And that is so true. I mean, in a lot of ways, going through that was like going through the wandering or wilderness for us in seminary. And God shaped us and molded us into the people that he wanted us to be. And that's what God does during those times. I don't know that God was really that interested in the fact that all of us got Masters of Divinity degrees or whatever. He was interested in shaping us and molding us for his purposes. That's what he does. That's what he is about, molding us and making us. Numbers 11:1 tells us how the Israelites kind of reacted when they're going through this wandering process. And just to kind of give you the theme of Exodus and Numbers, it was a time of whining. It was a time of complaining. Numbers chapter 11, verse 1. Now the people complained about their hardships in the hearing of the Lord. And when he heard them, his anger was aroused. Then fire from the Lord burned among them and consumed some of the outskirts of the camp. And this kind of theme happens over and over. They complain and they complain and they complain. What was one of the things that they complained about a lot? They complained about the food. That's a common theme. Numbers 11:4, a couple verses later. I'm going to read this from the Message Bible because I just love how it puts it. The riffraff among the people had a craving, and soon they had the people of Israel whining. So it starts with the riffraff, they're called, and then it becomes all the people. And they say, why can't we have meat? We ate fish in Egypt, and we got it for free. To say nothing of the cucumbers, the melons, the leeks, and onions, and garlic. But nothing tastes good out here. All we get is manna, manna, manna. And they're whining, they're complaining about the food that God has given them. And over, God takes care of them. He gives them manna and quail, and they hit a rock, and they have water. And Scripture tells us in Deuteronomy that their sandals, that God actually miraculously made their sandals last longer. And don't miss this in this passage. The complaining is contagious. It starts with the riffraff, but then, and they're on the outskirts, and it says, then the whole camp is kind of infected. That's kind of how it works, isn't it? In your family, one person starts complaining. It's a couple of neighbors. It just takes a few co-workers, a half a dozen people in church, and then it just starts to catch on. And it spreads like an infection, and it's toxic to the home. It's toxic to the work environment. It's toxic in our friendships. And it's like a cancer in a church. And people who complain, regardless of the setting, it's just like this dark cloud that walks everywhere. And it just makes the sun go away, so to speak. They're like sponges, and they suck all the joy out of whatever environment that they're in. Came across some research by the University of Denver. This was fascinating to me. They were looking at predictive factors for determining what makes marriages last. And so they were looking at the first 10 years of marriages and trying to see if they could come up with some factors that would, you know, that they could see that if these factors were present, that the marriage probably had a really good chance of succeeding. Here's one of the factors they came up with. If per 100 comments, only 5 of the comments were negative, like whining, complaining, criticizing, if it was 5 or under per 100, that marriage had a great chance of succeeding. If there were 10 or more negative comments per 100 in that marriage, they discovered that that marriage would have a very good chance of failing. I just thought that was fascinating. That our whining and complaining can do that much damage to our relationships, especially to our marriage. Well, the people of Israel, they're on this journey and they're whining and they're complaining. They're complaining about the food. That started like, you know, as soon as they pulled out of the driveway. Exodus chapter 16, verse 3, the whole company of Israel complained against Moses and Aaron there in the wilderness. The Israelites said, why didn't God let us die in comfort where we had lamb stew and all the bread we could eat? You brought us out into this wilderness to starve us to death, the whole company of Israel. So they're talking about their lamb stew and all this bread they had to eat. And they're did you notice they're kind of making this sound like it was good times? They were slaves, right? They make it sound like it was one big tailgating party there in Egypt. We had barbecue every day. Remember the hibachi grill? Yeah, it was great. It was free. No, you were slaves. You were slaves. Folks, listen. That is what people do who complain. They see every situation as better than the one that they're currently in. Whether it's from the past or whether it's someone else's situation, everything is better than what they've got. And you know, God showed grace to his people. And he provided for the Israelites again and again. And then it was like God finally kind of got fed up. Here's what we read in chapter 11, Numbers, verse 18. God says, tell the people, consecrate yourselves. Get ready for tomorrow when you're going to eat meat. You've been whining to God. We want meat. Give us meat. We had a better life in Egypt. God has heard your whining and he's going to give you meat. You're going to get meat. And it's not just for a day that you eat meat, not 2 days or five or 10 or 20, but for a whole month. You're going to eat meat until it's coming out your nostrils. You're going to be so sick of meat that you'll throw up at the mere mention of it. And here's why. Because you have rejected God who is right here among you, whining to his face. Oh, why did we ever have to leave Egypt? God is like, you want meat? I'll give you meat. That's what he does here. And here's what God is doing. He's giving them some perspective. Is that not what our complaining oftentimes needs, is perspective? Some perspective. We lose sight of how blessed we are. We lose sight of what God has provided, and we just need some perspective. John Ortberg says, if we really wanted to change our lives and change our perspective with regards to complaining, we would learn four little words. It could be worse. But we don't tend to say that. We tend to say, I deserve better. This isn't fair. I want this. But what if we just looked at life like that? It could be worse. And it would put our complaining in perspective. It would make us more grateful. Could we just kind of repeat those words together, those four words, on the count of three? One, two, three. It could be worse. One more time. It could be worse. So mean it today. So when you go home and you walk into your house or your apartment or wherever you live, and there's a tendency to look around and say, boy, if I had their house, I'd be so happy. With passion, you say, it, say it with me, be worse. So tomorrow morning, you know, you get out of the shower, make the mistake of looking at your body in the mirror, and you say, it could be worse. You get in your car, and, you know, you wish you had a newer, faster, shinier one, you say, it could be worse. Tomorrow morning, you wake up, you roll over in bed, you see your spouse. Believe me, it could be worse, right? Get perspective. Sometimes we need perspective because we just get lost. It's not fair. God's not paying attention to me. We look what everybody else has, and we need perspective. I was reading about this article about spoiled kids, and it was talking about this guy who was on an airplane. And there's a child that's about 3 years old, and he's headed to Orlando for a conference, and this mom and her child and one other person who's not related to the mom and the child are sitting in front of him. And the child begins to get very upset because he doesn't have a window seat. And he just gets louder, and he begins to throw a tantrum, and he's just fussing, and his mom's like, but honey, we're going to Disney World, and you're going to see Mickey, don't you want to see Mickey? And she's telling him all this stuff about all the fun they're going to have at Disney and Orlando and all that stuff. And he's just screaming at the top of his lungs that he wants a window seat. I mean, they're on their way to the Magic Kingdom, and all he can think about is, I want a window seat. Does that sound familiar? We are on our way to heaven, and we just complain because we don't have a window seat. And we lose perspective. So a father's at his son's middle school baseball game. His son strikes out. The dad goes ballistic, he's cussing at his son, cussing at the umpire, blankety blank ball, umpire wouldn't need to wear glasses, and just carrying on and on and on. You know what I want to say? Dude, knock it off. You've got a healthy son that you're getting to watch. You are one of the 8% of people in the world. They get to drive and watch his son play a kid's game. Quit whining like a girl. Am I right? Yeah, come on. I'm so tired of that. Put any sport in there that you want to. We just lose perspective. I get that. We all find ourselves caught up in that. The Israelites, their story is, you know, complain and whine. And I think we sit there sometimes, we read that and say, well, I wouldn't complain about having to eat that stuff all the time. Come on, really? I mean, most of our houses, if our wife serves the same food twice in a row, leftovers the next day, well, I'm having leftovers again. Because that's the way we are. We need some perspective to remember how blessed we are. It could be worse. I read a testimony about a lady who took a mission trip to Tobago. And she was with a leper colony. And this leper colony, you know, leprosy, when it's not treated, is just a terrible disease. People lose fingers, they get disfigured, face, all those kind of, they lose digits, toes, those kind of things. And she said they were in the last worship service before she left, and they were singing, and somebody, you know, the song leader said, hey, would anybody, does anybody have a favorite? Is there a song that somebody wants to sing? And she said she looked back, and there's a lady in the very back, whose face was disfigured. Most of her nose would have been eaten up by leprosy. She didn't have any fingers left, but she had her hand up. And she picked the lady, the song leader picked her, and she said, this is a person with no fingers, disfigured face, leprosy. Can we sing? Can we count your many blessings one more time? And we complain about a hate. There's a book out. I haven't read it, but I've read the jacket and those kind of things. It's called 1,000 Gifts by Anne Volkskamp. And basically the premise of her book is this. Make it a practice in your life to find things to be thankful for. And she says, chronicle 1,000 blessings. Here's what the jacket says. Forget the bucket list that have us escaping our everyday lives for exotic experiences. How, Anne wondered, do we find joy in the midst of deadlines, debt, drama, and daily duties? What does the Christ-like life really look like when your days are gritty, long, and sometimes even dark? In 1,000 Gifts, Anne invites you to embrace the everyday blessing, embark on the transformative spiritual discipline of chronicling God's gifts. But we tend to focus on the negative and we lose sight of what to be thankful for. And here's why this is such a big deal to God. Whining is the opposite of worship. Worship is giving God glory for what he's doing in our life and what he has done. Whining is ignoring what God is doing and what God has done. It's overlooking that. It's the opposite of worship. For a very shortest of time, the nation of Israel was in that upper story as they left in chapter 10 when we first looked at it. And they were exciting and they were enjoying everything and the promises, and they're starting out on this great journey. But in no time at all, they're back in the lower story, looking around at just this way. Lower story, horizontal, 6 feet high. And it's a long journey, and they're eating the same thing every day, and it's dusty, and they're not happy. It's They're tired. And that's what people do who struggle with complaining, which is all of us at one point or another. That's what complainers do. Here's the perspective they have. The Israelites had this. God asked of me, what God is asking of me is too much. God, everything God's done for me isn't enough. Whatever God asked of me is too much, and whatever God has done for me isn't enough, and he should do more somehow. And we lose perspective just like the people in Israel. And I think we find ourselves in that mentality. We get in that space between where God's trying to teach us and we just lose perspective. And God sent his son to die for us. We lose perspective. Our response should be to acknowledge who God is and what he's done. But it's like God is holding up the Red Sea for us to cross and we're fussing and complaining because there's mud between our toes. That's kind of where we're at sometimes. Here's what I want to do. I'm going to do something very practical. I don't know if anybody mentioned to you, but I'm sure you've seen all the rubber bands. Here's what I want you to do. These rubber bands, I want you to put them on your wrist this week. Okay, in our children's department, all the kids are getting rubber bands too. In fact, this was Missy Callahan, our children's director's idea. You're going to put that rubber band on your wrist, and here's what's going to happen. Every time this week you complain or whine about something, somebody in your family can pop that rubber band. Okay? Now, I don't mean like, whack! We're not trying to put welts on people. But just, you know, enough to just be a reminder. So your kids are going to have them. All right? Your grandkids are going to have them. If you're just you as a couple, there's nobody living at home, participate in this. Don't be too cool for this. This will be a great reminder if you'll do it. Just every time. So, you know, tomorrow night when you sit down and the kids are like, I can't believe we're having soup again. Mom, just reach over. But tomorrow morning when you're at school and you're waiting in that car line, oh, this line is so long. Your kids have permission to reach over. So that's the way it works for the whole week. Just wear those rubber bands. Wear it to work. You know why? Because somebody's going to ask you, why are you wearing a rubber band today? Well, this is this thing we're doing in church. And you can tell them about it. Invite them to church. Tell them what goes on at your church. It's a great way because people are going to ask you why you're wearing a rubber band. So that's the plan this week. It'll be a great reminder to all of us to not complain and not to whine and remember the blessings that God has given us. Can I pray for us, please?